The symposium has been sponsored by the University of Manitoba Outreach Fund, University of Manitoba School of Art, Plug-In Institute of Contemporary Art, Mentoring Artists for Women's Art, University of Manitoba Distance Education, University of Manitoba Faculty Development Fund, and the Winnipeg Art Gallery. And by the way, my name is Diana Thornycroft. What I'm going to do is introduce the speakers, and I would wait for you. Please don't applaud until after I've finished introducing them all. Aaron Milrod is the guy with the hand up who really wants to sing Frère Jacques really badly. Is a member of Fraser Milner Casgrain, where he provides legal service to clients across Canada, the United States, and internationally who are involved in the visual, performing, and literary arts, music, publishing, media, and multimedia. He has written and lectured widely in all aspects of copyright, art law, publishing, and media law, and is the author of Artful Ownership, Art Law, Valuation, and Commerce in the United States, Canada, and Mexico. Aaron is a former board member of the Art Gallery of Ontario, the Contemporary Cultural Institute of the Royal Ontario Museum, and former president of Harbourfront Art Gallery. He is presently a board member of the Board of Trustees of the International Foundation for Art Research in New York and the International Board of Tel Aviv Museum and the Museum Trustee Association. He is currently chair of the George R. Gardner Museum of Ceramic Art. He is a regular speaker and commentator on the law and the arts and copyright at business and legal seminars in Canada and the United States, and has published numerous articles in these various areas for Canadian, British, and American publications, including lectures and articles on art and the Holocaust. So thank you, Aaron, for being here. Barbara Turfloth, hand up. Became the executive director and administrator of Canadian Artists Representation Copyright Collective. It's CARCC, but apparently it's just called CARC, in 1997, when CARFAC moved its national office to Toronto and its collective to Saskatchewan. In this capacity, and in addition to her duties as the CARC director, she has taught workshops on copyright for visual artists in almost every province of Canada. Barbara also currently serves on the CARFAC National Negotiating Team working under Status of the Artist legislation. In 1999, she successfully prepared and argued CARFAC's application for certification before Canadian Artists and Producers Professional Relations Tribunal as the Professional Association for Visual Art Media Artists in Canada. Prior to taking on her role with CARC, Barbara served as the CARFAC National BOD. What's that?
Board
of Directors, okay. As the Saskatchewan Rep, the Western Rep, and the Vice Representation Collective. In Saskatchewan, she served on the CARFAC Saskatchewan Board of Directors for a number of years in various capacities, including chair. During this time, she's also taught workshops for CARFAC Saskatchewan in various areas of artist rights. Jean Wells has edited books on Canadian film and is author of books on François Truffaut and Charlie Thorson. Sorry. His current project is editing a book-length manuscript by Graham McGinnis about his days at the National Film Board in the 1940s. McGinnis has written two books on Canadian art and memoirs about his association with the Group of Seven. Professor Walsh teaches in film studies program here at the University of Manitoba, there at the University of Manitoba, and is provost at University College. Mark Hostler of Negative Land.
Yikes!
Mark Hostler is a founding member of the group Negative Land since 1980. Negative Land has been creating records, video, radio, and live performances using appropriated sound, image, and text. Taken mostly from corporately owned mass culture, Negative Land rearranges these bits and pieces to make them say things they never intended to. In doing this kind of cultural opposition and cultural jamming, Negative Land has been sued twice for copyright infringement and have, since 1991, been aggressively and publicly involved in advocating a significant reform of his nation's copyright laws. He's an American. As a member of Negative Land, Mark has written essays and articles on these issues for Billboard Magazine, Keyboard Magazine, College Music Journal, NYU Law Commentator, and others, and has lectured all over the US, as well as London, Berlin, Amsterdam, Melbourne, Winnipeg, and Honolulu. Besides doing lectures on his own, Mark has appeared at many showings of this to show his films, to speak, lecture, debate, and answer many questions that arise wherever Sonic Outlaws is shown. last person I'm going to be introducing is Natalka Husar. She was born in 1951 in New Jersey to Ukrainian immigration parents. She graduated from Rutgers University in 1973 with degrees in fine arts, and the same year moved to Toronto, where she lives and works. Catalog touring solo exhibitions include Faces, Facades, 1980, Behind the Irony Curtain, 1986, Milk and Blood, 1988 to 89, True Confessions, 1991, 92, Black Sea Blue, 1995, 96, and most recently, Blonde with Dark Roots, organized and circulated by the Art Gallery of Hamilton, 2001, 2003, which was at the Winnipeg Art Gallery, and it was a stunning show. Husar's work has been curated in a number of catalog group exhibitions, notably the Contemporary Canadian Figure, Macintosh Gallery in London, 1988, Dangerous Goods, Edmonton Art Gallery, 1990, The Wedding, A Ceremony, Art Gallery of York University, 1990, Art and Ethnicity, Canadian Museum of Civilization, Touring, 1991 to 95, and Perspectives, Canadian Women Artists at the McMichael Canadian Art Collection, 2002-2003. Natalka has received the support of the Ontario Arts Council and the Canada Council. In 1992, the CBC program Sunday Arts profiled Husar's work in a half-hour television documentary. Her work is represented in private and public collections, including the Canada Council Art Bank, the Canadian Museum of Civilization, and the National Gallery of Canada. So thank you all so much for being on this panel. The overall title of this symposium is called The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. It came about because I had done these drawings, and it was suggested that what I had done was going to get me into trouble. And I'll just make a very brief story, that these are the drawings that I learned upon talking to Aaron that I could not show them in Canada. There was an article in the Globe. They were picked up by a woman showing work in New York called Illegal Art, and that's where I met Mark, and the whole symposium came out of that. When I was organizing the symposium, I thought about that there's good news, bad news, and ugly news about copyright. And initially I thought, okay, well, Barbara Terfloth, she's going to be talking about the good news about copyright, but after this morning's interesting breakfast discussion, I've discovered that she does have good news to talk about copyright, but she also has a little bit of bad news. Aaron, when I went to him, I wanted him to tell me good news, but he told me bad news. So he's going to, and once again talking this morning, he's got bad news, but he also has promising news. Jean and Natalka have complex news, and Mark, his news is really ugly, but he's really good at telling it. So we'll start with the first speaker. It will go from Aaron to Barbara, Jean, Mark, Natalka, and then we'll be answering questions after the presentation. Oh, I just wanted, sorry. The one thing that when I decided to pull the work, I did pull it all, except I took this one. This is Bert. Yes, this is Bert, and I thought, okay, if I change Bert drastically, maybe I'll show him. So I changed him. Michael looked at this and he said, it just looks like Bert dressed up as Frank Zappa. So, I mean, clearly everyone saw this at my show and just sort of, wink, wink, we know who this really is. So, okay, thanks. So we'll start with Aaron. You're going to be starting?
Thanks. Can I stand here?
Yep. Can you hear me? Canada in 1924 passed the Copyright Act and joined the International Community of Nations, who had signed what was known as the Berne Convention. And the Berne Convention was an international agreement amongst the different industrialized countries of the world to protect what was known as intellectual property in the copyright area. Copyright was one area of what is known as intellectual property, the other areas being trademark, patent, industrial design. And the whole idea of copyright was an attempt to give to creators a right to control their product their productivity. And so the act came into force saying that if a creator of an original work in the literary, artistic, musical, or dramatic area created such a work, that artist then had what was known as an artistic monopoly on the use of that particular material in all media, be it two-dimensional, three-dimensional. And as radio was developed, it was applied to radio, and later on, as television was created, it was applied to television. The Copyright Act has always tried to play catch-up because technology is always further ahead than the laws that try to deal with technology. So the concept was that you would have an original work. It would be something in the literary, artistic, musical, or dramatic area, and the first owner of that copyright would ordinarily be the creator. There were a few exceptions that were set out, such as if you are a full-time employee of a corporation doing this kind of artistic or literary work, such as somebody who works for the Hallmark Card Company and draws drawings for the cards or puts the verses in of roses are red and violets are blue kind of thing, that the employer would own the copyright. As well, because we are a Commonwealth nation, Her Majesty the Queen is outside the Copyright Act. And so if you do anything for Her Majesty the Queen, she owns copyright unless your contract says otherwise. Now, Her Majesty is not going to come to you and ask you for a portrait, but Her Majesty is, in fact, the emanation through the province and the federal governments and all crown and federal agencies. So if a creator does work for the CBC, for instance, or the Department of Works, then you have to be very careful in respect to copyright, because if the contract says nothing, the copyright is owned by Her Majesty. Well, how do you get this copyright? In order to comply with the international agreement, copyright in Canada is obtained automatically. There are no formalities in obtaining and owning copyright as a creator. You only have to create that original work. Unlike trademarks, patents, and industrial designs, which have to be registered, you as a creator do not have to register. All you have to do is be the person who creates the original work. In other words, the first to do it. And if you do get copyright, where do you get it for? Well, because again of the Berne Convention and later on the Universal Copyright Convention, if you have copyright in Canada, you automatically have copyright in most of the industrialized world, automatically. And that includes the United States, which in 1978 signed the Berne Convention. Before that, in order to protect your copyright in the United States, you had to either register it, similar to trademarks and patents and so on, or you had to put a copyright symbol, your name and the year, on the object itself. So if you get this copyright, and it's worldwide, how long do you get it for? Well, under our act, it's for the lifetime of the creator and for 50 years thereafter, so that the estate of the creator can take advantage of all the copyright rights. And the copyright rights include the right to license that copyright, so that the copyright is like your house, and the licenses are the little rooms that you can rent out, so that you can license your artwork, for instance, for a poster in Canada for a two-year period. You can license that same image in the United States for a greeting card for 3 years. You can license it in Europe for whatever you want to there. And you obtain royalties for all these different licenses, which still indicates that you still own the copyright. And what you've done is you've rented out portions of it for different purposes in different places. And that is a right that exists in favor of the artist and the artist's estate as well. In addition, in Canada, we have a very unusual provision that says that 25 years after the death of the artist, whether or not the artist signed away the copyright during his or her lifetime, it automatically comes back into the estate of the artist for the last 25 years. And the intent was that if that artist has become famous, if that copyright is worth something, then we should not punish that artist by having licensed away or given away or assigned away, transferred away the copyright during his or her lifetime for the term of the copyright. But the last 25 years should come back into the estate to enable the heirs and beneficiaries to obtain any increased benefits that the artist could have obtained because of the increased fame and fortune. And so that is a special provision that exists in this country. In addition to copyright, we also have something called the droit moral, the moral rights. And the moral rights are three rights that exist in favor of the creator. One, the right to be known as the creator of the work, the patrimony concept. So you have the right to be identified. You also have the right not to be identified and to say, this is not my work. Secondly, you have the right to prevent the work from being altered, mutilated, or in any way changed to the prejudice of the reputation and the honor of the artist, so that you can prevent the work from being cropped or printed over or used in a fashion that has been an alteration of the work. The third moral right is the right to prevent the work from being used in association with a product or a service that could be prejudicial to you. So if an artist is an avowed vegetarian and is going to have an exhibition at the Art Gallery of Winnipeg to be sponsored by a meat packer, that artist can say, sorry, that is prejudicial to my reputation and honor. And these are three particularly important rights. In addition to that, because of the lobbying of CARFAC, artists in Canada, Canadian artists, have an additional right, and that is the right to be paid for the exposure for the exhibition of their artwork. The argument was used that every time a song is played, royalties are paid. Why are we, the artists, not being paid for every time our artwork is shown? So CARFAC was able to obtain an amendment to the Copyright Act, which stated that, yes, if you show the work in public, with certain exceptions such as your dealer, you get paid a fee, and a fee was established by CARFAC with the copyright people. If copyright is breached, there are certain penalties under the Act, both civil penalties, namely fines, and also criminal penalties. And the criminal penalties have been added and increased recently because organized crime has gotten involved on an international basis with copyright and stealing copyright and putting out bootleg music. In fact, in Italy, 80% of the music that comes out, I'm told, is under organized crime. And we've had situations in Canada as well. So that's sort of the background of what is available to the artist here in Canada, and I can add to it later on with various questions.
Thank you, Aaron. There are four seats up here at the front. Any of you who want to five seats, please come on up and take them. It's a race. Okay. Now I'd like to ask Barbara Turfloff to speak.
I'm going to follow up on what's just been said in positive arguments for the protection of... In presenting positive arguments for keeping copyright as it is, for increasing protection in the future, and defending copyright protections for creators of original works. And in presenting this defense, I'm going to give examples of the bad and the ugly that occur in our world and that drive home to us the need for the copyright protections that we have. And I do acknowledge, as an artist myself, that copyright can be problematic when we're creating and that it can be used as a muzzle when we're doing work of a social commentary and such areas of art. And we want to be able to be free to use what's out there in the public in our art. But again, I'm sitting here on this fence, we also have to remember that a lot of those rights that are in the copyright law are rights we fought for as creators, and that copyright law was created and set up to protect the creator of an original work. And there are exceptions under copyright law that do allow us to do some things. We can engage in criticism and analysis. And I don't know if some of the artists' works that you're going to see later can fit under that and therefore be allowed under Canadian copyright law. When I get calls from artists about using something in their work, I don't ever tell them not to use it. What I do tell them is assess the risks, and if you're willing to take the risks, do it. But you have to remember that there may be risks involved and you might get sued. One of the ugliest facts for a visual artist is that our annual incomes are dismally low. The Writers Guild recently put out statistics on their writers' community, $12,000 a year is the annual income. And visual artists aren't much different. And why is this? Why are we not making any money? Are we bad artists? Are we bad managers? Are we bad business people? I don't think it's any of those, because whether the art is good, bad, or ugly, we're still poor. And one of the ugly statistics that comes out of my work with the Copyright Collective is that 50% of our incomes we're waiving or being asked to waive on a regular basis. It's a grisly routine for most artists. Do I say no to the show because I'm not going to get paid? Or do I show for nothing? And many times the requests or demands for us to waive our incomes come from people who are earning good incomes or who are getting government grants, our tax money, in order to operate, or are from institutions who couldn't exist without our work. So in our own community, which is the artistic community, we're faced with requests and demands or outright using of our work without asking. And as I mentioned before, that the most common requests come from institutions and organizations that do pay professionals and non-professionals. The janitors get paid, the accountants get paid, the managers get paid, the staff gets paid, the director gets paid, the curators get paid, but the artists do not. And these same paid people, they're not asked to waive 10% of their income for an exhibition, whereas an artist on $12,000 of a year is asked to waive a $1,200 exhibition fee for a four-week show. That's 10% of their income that they're being asked to waive. We're being guilted into waiving it because we're told that the institutions don't have any money, or we're being told that this is good exposure. And one of my favorite quotes from one of the founders of CARFAC is, "In Canada, we can die of exposure." So the myth of the happy starving artist is another one we have to contend with. I was at a conference in Ottawa, and I was sitting in a room full of arts administrators who were saying things like, they will keep on making art. They don't need status and rights. If they were more committed and dedicated, they would earn money. They shouldn't prostitute themselves by demanding to be paid. So there's this internal disdain in our own communities for the professional artists. They say things like, everybody's an artist, and so let's just deal with the ones that aren't calling themselves professional because they're not asking to get paid. I wanted to end off with a few comments from the Creators Coalition, the Creators Copyright Coalition, which is a new organization that formed about a year ago. It's made up of groups of creators, writers, artists, all kinds of organizations across the country that defend or that represent creators of original works. And their foundation is the UN Declaration of Human Rights, the one clause that says, everyone has a right to the protection of the moral and material interests resulting from any scientific, literary, or artistic production of which he or she is the author. That's what we're there to defend. And the Creators Coalition is putting together documents and arguments to the copyright reform that's occurring right now to protect the creators' rights. Our economic and moral rights are constantly being threatened and eroded. There are huge lobbies from educators, librarians, media businesses, internet service providers, and other users of copyright works, including individual consumers, to use our works without the artist seeing a cent. So when, as creators, we are arguing against the restrictions that copyright is putting on us in creation of our work, we have to remember that we're also putting in jeopardy our own rights under the copyright law.
Thank you, Barbara. And now I'll ask Jean to say a few words.
Diana mentioned that my news was going to be complex. I guess it's especially complex for people listening to this on tape or on the radio, since I'm going to be using images, or some images. I'm here with a simple and perhaps classic story because of a book that I wrote called Cartoon Charlie, The Life and Art of Animation Pioneer Charles Thorson, who was a Winnipegger, a political cartoonist and illustrator of the Eaton's catalog back when all the Eaton's products were hand-drawn. And then at age 45, moved to Los Angeles and worked for all the large animation factories or animation companies in Los Angeles, starting with the Walt Disney Company. Worked there for 2 years as a character designer. They would come to him with an idea for a character, a verbal idea for a character, and he would come up with a concept and present it to them, and they would use that. And if it was accepted, he would create a model sheet, which had the major poses of the characters. These model sheets would be reproduced for everybody at the company, and there would be some standardization in their animation. Charlie was a rather footloose kind of a guy and a cantankerous person as well, I guess you'd say. Never worked at a place very long, got in an argument with Walt Disney over a variety of things, and moved on to MGM, then left MGM to work for Warner Brothers, and then left Warner Brothers to work for Fleischer Brothers, and then left Fleischer Brothers to work for Terry Toons, and eventually ended up back in Los Angeles working for Columbia and George Pal Animation Studios. He was a character designer. He first designed the prototype for Bugs Bunny when he was at Warner Brothers, and Sniffles the Mouse, and Little Inky, a black African character that's now politically incorrect, but was very popular with Warner Brothers audiences in the 40s. Little Hiawatha, Elmer Elephant, various things for Walt Disney. It took me about six, because he moved around so much and he had so many different occupations, he ended up being a book designer and book writer, children's books. Because he moved around so much, it took me about 6 years to do the project. And in the course of my research, I talked to a lot of people that were animation researchers, and they gave me dire warnings that this was overly ambitious and that I was going to have a special difficulty with Walt Disney Company and Warner Brothers over copyright issues. And I thought, I'm writing a history. I am promoting their characters as much as anything. And they will not only not hassle me, but be grateful to me for what I've been doing. So I played it by the book. I was in constant communication with the Disney Corporation and researched in their archives quite regularly. And they had told me that I had to get legal permission from them once my book was in final form. And so I sent them my Disney chapter completely written out. I sent them photocopies of all the illustrations I was going to use. And I gave them the timetable for the printing and the budget. And I sent this about 8 weeks before we were scheduled to go to press. After they and their communications had told me that they normally get back to people within 6 weeks. And so after about 7 weeks, we sent them a registered letter saying that since they hadn't gotten back to us, we assumed that everything was fine. In fact, everything wasn't. They immediately sent us a fax and said, if you go ahead with the publication as it's now conceived, we will begin legal proceedings against you. And to make a long, painful story short, we had about 60 Disney images in the book. It's the book, ironically, won a prize for best illustrated book. And every chapter, every page is lavishly illustrated, except for the Disney chapter. We had about 60 images or so in the Disney chapter, several per page, as much as 5 to 8 on a couple of pages. When they finally got back to us over some bargaining about how many we could use and what it would cost us, we had to take those 60 images out, including all of the color images. So we had to completely redesign the book because we had 4 pages of color images from Walt Disney Studios. And so it meant repaginating, redesigning the color section. The middle section of the book is all the color illustrations with no Disney. And we had to completely redesign the Disney chapter and take out all our images. We eventually settled on the number 8. We could use 8 black and white images from Walt Disney Company, none on the cover, none on the interior, and no color. So it's rather ironic to me that it was a best illustrated book. Now, the complete irony of this is that Disney claimed that they were protecting their valuable Disney properties. That properties word is the one that's quite reprehensible to me. But they owned the copyright on characters, but they didn't own the images that I was using. These were from a private collection. And so although they owned the copyright on these characters, they didn't have the images themselves, only the images that appear in the movie and in some leftover books in the archive. These are all original drawings. Those had to be taken out. This is from Elmer the Elephant. And I'll go through a whole bunch of them. This is from a picture called Woodland Cafe, Academy Award-winning short Disney film. Those images are personally hand-drawn images, what were called presentation images. They would come to Charlie and ask him to come up with a concept. He would present them with these images, and then they would go from there. This is from a Mickey Mouse called the Moose Hunters. This is a sketch for a scene in Elmer Elephant. I won't go through. These are images from The Old Mill, another Academy Award winning picture. This is from probably the movie that he had the most influence on, Little Hiawatha. You probably all recognize that. He did much of the writing and virtually all of the character design and scene design for that. These are his images for the Seven Dwarfs, 6 of the Seven Dwarfs. And final couple, Elmer Elephant characters and more Little Hiawatha characters. These all had to be removed from the book. They only exist in the private collection in Vancouver and in the color photocopies I have here because Disney chose to have me not reproduce them. I guess the moral of the story is, even though you play by the rules, Disney wants to have their own official histories. And if you don't measure up, even though they okay the script, they have tacitly okayed all the images, it seems to me they were intent on sabotaging the book because their initial cost was something like $1,500 per image, black and white, to be included in the book. We eventually negotiated that down so we could afford it, but if they had stuck by the initial figure, it would have bankrupted the book. The book would have been a no-go. And it seems to me that that was what their original intent was. Only allow their official books to be on the market, restrict everything else so that it doesn't really compete. So I'll end on that perhaps complex, but certainly depressing note for myself. Thank you.
Thank you, Gene. Now we'll have Mark Hostler speak.
Hey. My name is Mark. I was just curious before I get going, how many people here, could you raise your hand, how many folks were at my presentation last night? Okay, but a lot of you weren't. Well, I'm part of a group called Negative Land. We've been around for about 23 years now, and we like mixing funny noises together. And very early on, we really liked taking things from the world around us, mixing it into the audio that we made. And for the world around us, it wasn't just the sounds of birds chirping. It was things like television and movies and talk radio. And there's this interesting tension has developed between, well, a lot of the things that Barbara talked about and stuff that Aaron talked about, when you're, I agree with, about trying to protect the artist's interests. But what's happened is that culture now has become something very, very different. It's a lot of culture that's out there is mass-produced. It's corporately marketed and owned. And Walt Disney's an amazing example of a company who has made millions and millions of dollars off of using characters that are they could make films out of because they were in the public domain. So just think of Pinocchio, The Little Mermaid, Hercules, Hunchback of Notre Dame, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, Cinderella, Sleeping Beauty. They all had access to this stuff because it was in the public domain. But now, because Walt Disney is a corporation, because Walt Disney is as a corporation is immortal, it is not a human being, it is not Walt Disney, it's this thing that lasts forever, they want to control and profit from this stuff forever. They would like to control it in a completely sort of, what I sort of think of as this kind of omnipotent, godlike sort of way. For me, growing up as a kid in the United States, I've just watched a lot of TV, surrounded by ads, and our early work was not intended on us being very critical of this. It just made perfect natural sense to us to mix this stuff into our music, because it's part of the world that's out there. Over the years, our work became more critical, and of course, eventually, we were famously sued in 91 because we stepped finally on the wrong toes. Our good friends from Ireland, the group U2, and I talked about that a lot last night about what happened. So it forced us into having to really think about these issues and look at all this stuff. And I really think that when you look at what I'm more interested in is what's good for the evolution of art and culture and science and ideas over the whole of human history. And I think what's happening right now, especially in the last decade, and especially since the passage of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act in the United States, is that the corporate interests in that balance that copyright is trying to strike are completely running the show. It's totally out of control. And copyright never was supposed to grant anyone some total, complete property right. It always was supposed to be a balancing act that recognized that we want to give creators the chance to make some money off of their work, but that there's no such thing as a truly, totally original idea, that we all build upon the past. Or Isaac Newton said something like, "I see so far because I stand upon the shoulders of giants." So he was a smart man. And so that's kind of our approach to creating art, you know, is we see this stuff around us, we want to be able to use it, and we're not pirating it, we're not bootlegging it, but we are mutilating it. It's the one part of the moral rights, what do you call them, rules, laws? What's the right word?
Just moral rights.
The moral rights that you have here in this country that, of course, I take great issue with. Negative Land's work is entirely about taking other people's creations and mutilating them, if you want to use that word. It's kind of an aggressive-sounding word. But we're combining them in all kinds of ways that the original creators never intended. We're usually mixing them with hundreds of other different sources, including our own original stuff. And in the end, I think we make something that, though it is taken from other people's work, it actually, interestingly enough, sounds rather uniquely Negative Land. A lot of our work really has kind of a sound to it, I think. So how about that? It's kind of ironic. Well, one of the questions of the title of this panel was, how much can you get away with? What I found in the United States, and this, I think this will be talked about a little later in the panel, is The United States, I think that corporations are so totally in control that I personally find no hope in trying to change the course of events. I actually think here, especially I've been hearing some wonderful things this morning from our breakfast we had that Aaron can talk more about later, you actually do have a chance at kind of affecting some things. I think that there's a little bit more public input, and that's wonderful. But in the U.S., you know, we're so completely dominated in every aspect of our lives, and the worst, of course, is in our politics, by corporate interests, that I'm not really worrying about trying to change the laws. I'm more interested in trying to figure out what I can do in my own personal life and maybe encourage others. Maybe Negative Land sets a little bit of an example and encourage other people to basically kind of commit acts of cultural civil disobedience, you know. Ignore the, if you're making collage and making some kind of interesting art, just ignore the fucking laws, please, and just make your stuff. And for the most part, most likely, you'll be able to get away with it because there's far too many people out there doing this kind of work now for them to ever keep up with it. And though I do speak about this stuff a lot, it's not something I want to make a career out of. I do want to go back to actually making our stuff and kind of not worrying about it. And we actually haven't not been sued since the two lawsuits that happened in the early 90s. We actually have been left alone, though if you listen to our work, we've gone on to do so-called infringing things far worse than the stuff we were sued over. But they were all part of a collage. No one ever felt threatened, and nothing ever happened. Anyway, I want to play a couple fun things here that we've made, and most of our work is usually made combining things we've appropriated in combination with stuff we've created ourselves. But we sometimes like to make things that are 100% totally, completely stolen. That's fun to do, too. So I just want to play this. This is some examples of how far can you go. Well, probably most of you are familiar with a film called The Sound of Music. Hey? And you probably know a little song by sung by Julie Andrews, My Favorite Things. Okay, well, let's listen to our Negative Land's version of that.
Kittens and...
Whoops. Sorry.
Raindrops on kittens and schnitzel on roses. Nose cream on my nose. Whiskers and crisp eyelashes with noodles. Wild geese that fly with their wings tied up with strings. These are a few of my favorite things. Ponies in dresses and warm, warm doorbells and brown raindrops. Girls with blue whiskers tied up with noodles. Wild kettles that fly with bright copper wings. These are a few of my favorite things. The dog bites, the bee stings. I simply remember my favorite things. And then I feel so bad. That sting on colored girls tied up with blue satin sashes. Wild brown girls tied up in warm strings. Wild, wild white girls that melt into nose cream. These are a few of my favorite things. Nose cream on ponies, nose cream on kittens. Nose cream on roses and nose cream on mittens. Bells and 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 wild geese. When the bee stings, I simply remember my dog bites, and then I feel so, so.
So that's actually going to be on the next record we put out. And this particular project, each track is actually completely made 100% out of stuff we appropriated. Do I have like a couple more minutes?
Yep. Or what?
Okay. I just want to play a little bit of something. Just I'm not going to play all of it here, but y'all, how many of you know Ethel Merman? Okay. She's kind of a brat. This is going to really communicate out there because she projects, let me tell you. Just a little bit more here. This is kind of a fun one where we kind of changed around what Ethel is singing about it again. Let's see. Oops. Let me see if I've queued this up right.
There's no business like stealing, like no business I know. Everything about it is appealing. Stealing everything the traffic will allow. Nowhere could you get that happy feeling when you are stealing people like show people. There's no stealing like stealing show people. The headaches, the heartaches, the backaches, the flops. Like a drum. When you're stealing, you get that sheriff who escorts you out of town. You're broken-hearted, but you go on. Even when you are stealing the turkey that you know will pound, you may be stealing out in the cold. Still, you wouldn't change it for a sack of gold.
Leave it at that. So thank you.
And now we'll conclude the presentations with Natalka Husar.
Thanks. Well, I come also to this panel from the point of view of freedom of expression, like Mark. After...
Should you get more... Get the microphone closer to you. It'll work.
Maybe I'll just get up. Yikes. Can I handle both? After the show, can you hear me? The show that was here at the Winnipeg Art Gallery, Blonde with Dark Roots, had traveled to Toronto and to Art Gallery of Hamilton. I received a letter from Harlequin. Hello? I received a letter from Harlequin Romances accusing me of violating the Copyright Act. Because in the in this body of work, I did small paintings on top of old Harlequin book covers. Basically, they took a very broad and aggressive view of their right and sort of were corporate bullies. And also, they completely did not understand. They didn't get what I was doing on so many levels. So that you understand what I was doing, and I'm going to show you some slides just briefly of this work and how I work. And also, I did some slides just a day before I left here of the correspondence of some of the letters that that followed, and I've never shown these letters. And I haven't seen them on the screen. I was going to read them to you, but I thought they sort of read like a Harlequin romance, really. So basically, just in one sentence, what I've been doing over the last 10 years I've been dealing with the cultural shock of the post-Soviet era. So what I've been doing has nothing to do with Harlequin at all. I haven't been attacking them or anything, like not social commentary about them. I've been talking about how the third world has been zooming into the first world at a faster than you can say copyright, and what kind of awkward distortions and mutations occur because of that. Now, because I don't do sort of the 6 o'clock news, I use a combination of fact with fiction that has always interested me, and I've always been interested in sort of allegory. And the characters that I've been painting are not actual people, they're people that I invented. And for this new wave of immigration coming from the ex-Soviet Union, specifically I'd say Soviet Ukraine, because that's sort of an area that I'm more familiar with, I invented these fictitious teenage girls, only because they were, that age is sort of the age of being on the border between adulthood and childhood, experience, innocence, and sort of a metaphor for being between two worlds. Has nothing to do, I wasn't interested per se in the prepubescent girls. They were just awkward, and that was a metaphor for that transition, that move to another, from the east to the west. Now, what else did I want to say? Besides these characters, I also am interested in the relationship between that immigration, this new wave that's coming from the third world, and the less hyphenated, but still hyphenated Canadians that are like me. And for that relationship, I thought of using this allegory of a trashy extramarital affair. And I started doing these sort of this sub-narrative about this affair on these Pulp Fiction covers, on these Harlequin covers. And I've been collecting these Pulp Fiction books and Harlequin covers mainly because of the titles, because the titles have these yearnings, they're outdated sort of desires. And when I would put my own paintings on, along with these titles, it created this strange mutation, this sort of time warp, and that seemed to really fit in to what I was doing. So, so I will show you some slides and then I'll answer questions afterwards. And I very quickly sort of scrambled this, put the slides together. They're sort of not linear. They're kind of, I want to show you the scale of the works because that's very important, that there were large, there was a grand narrative and then a tiny narrative, and why I had to use these, I had to paint on these book covers for that effect. Okay. For the characters, I'll just introduce the protagonist. I'm going to go very quickly, just so that. I use how I create characters. I actually just focus that. All I want you to just see is the male figure, because he ends up being symbolic for in the works that follow. This is a painting from the mid-80s where I painted this self-portrait as Our Lady of Mississauga, where I used this fictitious little husband, sort of like an adult Jesus. And he, so this guy ends up being in the paintings as sort of a symbol of a middle class, middle age, middle management, middle, sort of Canadian. Now, okay, we'll go just a painting from another previous body of work, because how I create characters are they're composites. I've always done composites. I used to work actually in the forensic lab at one point. I've been fascinated with like putting together features of, and this painting, these girls that are in the foreground. It's a painting actually that's at the National Gallery. Those girls are girls. If we look at this one girl with that bow. This she has that Mickey Mouse shirt. Disney never saw that, eh? she's sucking her thumb in this this sort of, okay, and this is how she grows up in my mind. These are all studies, okay? From that painting, I took her, and she's rather than suck her thumb, she's sucking her middle finger in this kind of awkward sense of growing up, okay? Then here she is in a grander painting. Okay. Then here she is in a study where she's a little bit older, but it's still this sort of, what I'm interested in is in that psychological scarring that 70 years of Soviet rule have caused. And here she is in a Pulp Fiction, that same girl, in this under this wonderful title, Meant for Each Other, where they sort of deserve each other. But it's the painting, like, this is not about about trashy sex as it appears. It is about a relationship and that between two generations, and it's a and two waves of immigration, and about sort of mutual dishonesties and expectations and non-commitments that are a metaphor for that immigration. Okay. Now, I changed, as you can see, the hussar, the harlequin to a hussar romance, right? But left the author's names on the spine and the ISBN numbers that... Okay, I'll show you some other characters quickly. Okay, this is just a shot in my studio where, you know, I work very much like a writer or a filmmaker, where I create these characters. So these are just Xeroxes of the actual paintings. Just quickly, like another character. So here's a study of this girl. So then I sort of, you know, she got braces on her teeth. Then I dressed her up in fur, tweezed her eyebrows, made her smile a different way. Okay, well, this is just a shot in the studio where you can see how I overpaint. This is one of the covers that Operation Love is sort of waiting for. Okay, and here she is, that same girl, on this on this miniature. Now, the scale is very important here because the paintings are grand, are large, like 9 feet, 10 feet tall. And then these are tiny, you know, 4 inches by 6 inches. So, and then the whole idea of, you know, Cinderella and Mink is so dated, and yet the desire is contemporary, but that sort of makes it, creates this time warp. For me, it was interesting to just paint that same character on the size where the head is the size of a loony, as opposed to life size, right? At the same time. So there is a this whole piece library has a long narrative, and just another girl, this blonde, her friend, and she puts on a wig, smiles.
What were the circumstances that this comes to the attention of the publishers who are unhappy?
I'll show you. I'll tell you in just a second. I'll lead to the letters. Here are the two girls together, okay, in a grand painting. Here they are in one of the covers, but the same characters. Here the plot thickens. So here, this is the husband from Our Lady of Mississauga has grown up, and so he is the other character. And this girl is changing too. She got a bouffant hairdo. Another painting with two new characters. Okay, that same girl in this imitation marriage, and it's that relationship became sort of like an. I love that phrase, imitation marriage, because. That hotel room was like Canada, sort of that surrogate home, not a real home at this time. So non-committed. And it thickens, you know. There is the sense of humor, sort of. It was kind of a black humor. But actually the paintings are, they're not at all about this relationship between a guy and these young girls. They are about... They are about contemporary history and what's happening with the East and West. Right? So, this is an important. It's backwards, but I'm going to show this slide again. Actually, so later. So, it's the Garden of Dreams, and this is actually I use myself as well as one of the players, and this is kind of a version of me with one of the girls, kind of embracing her in the Garden of Dreams and giving her, passing on her, my mink stole to her, sort of, in a nutshell, this particular image sort of is what all my work is about, which is the grotesque embracing the pathetic. Okay. Just a shot to show you scale. This is at the Winnipeg Art Gallery. So you can see like how important it was for that work to be tiny and grand at the same time, right? So that's just see that installation, and also this from the Art Gallery of Hamilton, where the portraits, which were studies, sort of like auditions in the theater, were also presented on another scale. Okay, so then. I couldn't resist this. As I photographed the paintings, the letters just before I came here, one of the books I have said, on a May morning. And in fact, on a May morning, I get this letter from Harlequin. So, actually, comes from a lawyer that says, I don't know if you could see, but it says that that they've heard that I collect these covers for their titles and tear off the covers to use in your art. Isn't that good? And that I violate, the author's names are identified in the works and believe that it is unfair to the authors who've chosen to contribute their works to Harlequin. And what they ask me to do is that they requested the original author's names, the ISBN numbers, the banner design, and I can't even read it.
The diamond design and banner.
And the books, that they be altered or obscured before any public exhibition. Now, these paintings are touring at this time, and they're booked to go on to the Beaverbrook Art Gallery and Edmonton and so forth. When I get this letter, I thought I'd just ignore it, actually. It came at a bad time. I was really busy. And these things always come at a bad time. And I just thought, they're nuts. You know, when I first saw Harlequin, I thought, hey, they want to buy something or something, right? So I ignore it. And then I get another letter saying, we want to hear from you. And basically, I realized that you can't ignore, you're not supposed to ignore this, right? So then I go looking for a lawyer, and I find through recommendations, I find a terrific lawyer, Anique Morrow, who is actually a criminal lawyer in Toronto, but has an art background, was actually an art restorer before she practiced criminal law. And she's very interested in this, and she's, you know, I talked to her, I have a consultation, and she asked me, what am I willing to do, you know? And I said, I'm not going to change anything. Like, I don't care, because I am not wrong. I don't care what the law is. I'm just not wrong. I've been doing what I've been doing all the time. I've been using collage or using what artists always do, you know, talking about the cultural landscape. And I said, I don't want to fight. And this reminded me, my mother-in-law has a magnet on her fridge that always says, I never quite understood it, but this explained my feeling to the T. It said, this little tacky thing, and it has like a daisy on it, and it says, I'm 51% sweetheart, 49% bitch. Don't push it. You know, and I thought, I'm going to write them, let them know that I don't want to fight, I don't want to be aggressive, but I don't want to budge because I don't feel I should be bullied and I should have to budge. You know, I am not aggravating them in any way. So, we decide to draft this letter coming from me as opposed to coming from a lawyer. Anique Morrow suggests that, you know, we'll just be, you'll say your case and it's less aggressive coming from the artist. So I write them and I tell them basically I tell them who I am. So that I am this artist that has the support of these institutions like the Winnipeg Art Gallery and so forth, that I have all this behind me. And that the work that they're asking me to change is out of my hands. It's touring for the next couple of years. And I also just say, and
you can read this.
It is my position that my work consists of artistic commentary on a social reality. As an artist, I believe I have the responsibility to communicate with society using a cultural lexicon that facilitates my message. You indicate that my message is a violation of the alleged moral rights of the Harlequin authors, whose name may appear in my work. Do these persons exist? And more importantly, have these identified persons truly objected to becoming part of an artistic work? If so, to what do they object? This does not appear to be clearly stated in your letter, and the solution you suggest is one of the most extreme measures conceivable to an artist. I cannot agree to such a proposal. Woo-hoo. It is when an artist is told that certain things cannot be painted that a debate which concerns us all begins. I have reflected on your words, and I have brought the issue forward in my discussions with students and faculty. I teach also at the Ontario College of Art and Design. There is a common thread in our belief that this request by Harlequin is wrong and that it raises an issue vital to free speech and artistic freedom. The issue deserves public debate, which I welcome. And then I just say how disappointed I am that, you know, they didn't want to buy it, you know, that... Well, I just say that it is also personally very disappointing to me to know that notwithstanding my nod to the Harlequin romance novel as a cultural icon, you are seeking to control and perhaps suppress my work. The position of Harlequin is opposite to that of the Campbell Soup Company in relation to the work of Andy Warhol and the American Tobacco Company, who purchased the painting by Stuart Davis of the Lucky Strike cigarette package, which now hangs at the Museum of Modern Art. And then I CC this letter to Torstar, Toronto Star, and to Harlequin, because actually Harlequin is owned by Torstar. And when I had the show in Hamilton, the Toronto Star gave me a half-page review with a reproduction of one of these Pulp Fictions. So, you know, I just want to see, maybe somebody made a bad judgment call. And I don't want to fight. I just want to say, like don't bully me, because what I'm doing, I actually teach. What I'm doing, I teach students how to do that. I mean, collage, taking something that is that will evoke a certain sense is something that I'm very interested in as an image maker. I love the fact that they look like they're these trashy pulp fictions, and then you come close and they're you go, ah, like there's something different there, and they create a sense of awkwardness. I find that that interesting. I also like the fact that these book covers were normally over the paintings on them were normally a very sort of homogenized, bland, generic white folks. And then I've overpainted that completely with these Eastern European others. So this very specific, they were so general before, and I've made them so specific, so much part of my story, which I'm telling. So nothing, I get this, I sent this letter off, and I hear nothing for, this is in June, and and I get offers, because I sort of have a big mouth, and I get offers to see if, you know, if I want to be on radio, if I want to be on TV, if I want to be interviewed. I'm in the same show with Mark and Diana, that Illegal Art show, with copies, actually, of these Xerox copies of this work. And I'm told, this is what I sort of resented, is that there's this climate of intimidation, and I'm told, you know, you mustn't talk about it, you mustn't show these letters, you know, don't aggravate the situation, because you never know, and you might lose your house, you know, if this goes further. Nothing. Then September, you think that, you know, you're scot-free. September, I get another letter, this time from Harlequin itself, saying that that what it, these persons actually exist, that I they've actually found the persons that, you know, that I said, you know, who are these artists, authors who object to being associated with Natalka Husar. Not a bad thing to be associated with, you know. So, and they say there's this, they found a writer in living in England, an older writer. And she is enclosing a letter. So they also, by now they backtrack and they say, you don't have to change the book covers that are being exhibited, but don't, you know, don't do any more in the future. And also, this is really interesting, they also got a whiff. We also want to bring to your attention that we have recently found copies of your work published as greeting cards. As you certainly know, by exploiting commercially our logo, the name of our authors, our romance banner, etc., you are increasing the potential damages. I never printed greeting cards. I had an overprint from the catalog of this show, and I made 8 sets of cards. I made them with my niece, sort of, you know, cut and paste, and gave them to people that helped me with the exhibition. So all in all, I mean, there's I think 3 sets in Winnipeg. One went to the Winnipeg Art Gallery, and one went to Mika Walsh, I think, and one to another friend. So I just wonder who of those friends of mine ever sent them a card, because I never did that. That's way too much, you know, work just to cut and paste. Anyway, then this is the image of the book cover that actually the writer, Sarah Craven, objected to. So, and that was the one that was backwards, right? So, and here, this is her letter, which is funny. And so she's been set up. She lives in England, but you know, somehow she got whiff that you know I had this show because it was brought to her attention. And I like the little critique. It says, I'll read this to you. To all intents and purposes, it looks like a facsimile of the Harlequin romance jacket of the 70s. It has the pale orange background color and the size and shape of the lettering look authentic. However, here all the resemblance ends. The illustration itself depicts two women, one an obese, shadowy figure, that was me, with an old-fashioned hairstyle, who is standing with an arm around the shoulders of a fully visible and much younger, slimmer blonde. The blonde who is simpering is clad in either a bikini or her underwear under a fur stole. Presumably the dark figure is meant to symbolize a typical reader. The blonde is the reader's fantasy, heroine, or other self, preoccupied with hence her garb with sex and money. If this woman, Natalka Huras, she misspelled my name, wishes to make blah blah, you know, but then, I should have responded sooner to what seems to be a breach of copyright in my pseudonym and title, but for some time I was too angry to formulate a rational reply. As it is, I wept when I saw the illustration first and have done so several times since. Also, my blood pressure, which has been normal for 3 years, began climbing again, and I may have to go back on medication. Anyway, so then she, you know, what are the legal implications of her totally unauthorized use of Sarah Craven and the Garden of Dreams and her for her financial gain? What level of damages in addition to an unreserved apology, etc.? Well, at this point, I say, you know, Anique, what am I, to tell you the truth, I felt embarrassed for them. You know, this is like scraping the barrel. This is so pathetic. And I said, maybe you should step in. So my lawyer started dealing with them directly, introduced herself, and explained to them that this writer despite her pathetic claim, has nothing to object to because I did nothing with her writing. In fact, I threw that book away instantly. You know, if anybody would have anything, any objection, the moral right would belong to the graphic designer, perhaps, of the cover. So anyway, at this point, we agreed to disagree. I did nothing. You know, I haven't heard since. Sufficient time has passed that I think that they realized that maybe somebody just made a bad judgment call. And that's where this stands. I have since continued to work on Pulp Fictions. I'll show you a painting that I continue to work with these characters.
Did the
and one of my girls baked them a cake. Now one of my girls is a caterer, and the plot continues. So on that note,
during this stuff when it all happened, I have to assume the galleries you were in knew this was going on.
Yes.
And were they concerned? Were they, to what degree?
The galleries, the commercial public galleries?
I don't know. Any of the people who were showing your work as this was happening, were they concerned? Were they considering, you know, pulling that part of your show or asking you to do it?
Well, I wouldn't pull that part of the show.
But they could then just say, we're not going to have the show. Then the whole show goes.
Well, everybody that I spoke with in the art community, and certainly the people who were behind this this work, they were flabbergasted as well.
But people are intimidated when lawyers come into the picture and legal threats. So sometimes people just back off and don't want to get into a fight. They don't have the money, even if they side with you, to deal with it. So that's why I wondered, there could have just been a chilling effect, you know, where the gallery just says, "Well, we're sorry, we like your work, but hey, we just don't know if we can show this thing."
Well, no, because clearly.
Closer to the mic.
They're in the wrong. So no. In fact,
the galleries were behind. You're saying that they support were supportive.
Well, everybody was amused by this, and I suppose it never got. It never went further, but no, they were behind me, and I was convinced that if this did go forward and it did go to court, I was going to create a publicity nightmare, and that was my only defense, and I.
That was our only defense too.
I was willing to do that, though it's. In my case, I wasn't not provoking Harlequin, and that wasn't my intent. I was doing paintings about immigration from ex-Soviet Union. Painting and using old books as collage.
I think what we'd do at this point is open the floor up to questions. There's a mic near the front, right here. Is that right? Where people could walk up and... Or you can yell the question and I'll repeat it to the rest of the audience.
Hi. I don't know if I need this mic, but I'll use it. Okay. I think that the paintings were great and everything. Maybe if I'd have had the same idea as you had, I might have changed the author's names. Just to avoid this type of thing. And so I'm thinking... What if somebody designed a really, you talked about the sticker your mom had and it was a kitschy thing. What if I designed some really kitschy, not to your taste at all, Easter tablecloth with the little bunnies and purple and yellow and just, the kind of thing that this is not me. And then I just wove through it your name. Because I like the juxtaposition of pink fluffy rabbits with an artist that likes the grotesque embracing the, I forget, not the meek, whatever it was.
Pathetic.
Pathetic. Okay, so I've made something that a lot of people in society, oh, it's Easter, okay, get out the purple bunnies and all this stuff that I personally don't like. But someone's done this, and now they've woven your name into it because to them it's this juxtaposition. And now all of a sudden your name's all over these things, and people are coming to you and going, wow, I didn't realize you make, Easter tablecloths and stuff. I mean, to me, it's just, you're saying, don't these artists realize it's part of some, or the names of the people, but it's their name, and now people are coming to them and saying, do you know that your name is next to a painting of a woman upside down on a bed, and she's naked, and...
But it's obvious. But they're all
pseudonyms, only known to the company.
Okay.
Yeah, they're not real names. I mean, but you still, the pseudonym is still copyrighted.
Okay.
Well, what I wanted to do, actually, is take a ballpoint pen and scratch out her name because she doesn't deserve to be on that cover. So, book covers I've painted since, I have eliminated them. The names were irrelevant, really. They were there, as part of the ISBN number and the price of 45 cents.
So if this happened to you that someone used your name because they thought it would be interesting, it would just be like a joke then, too, right?
Well, a little bit different, because it is my actual name, too. If they did use my name in vain like that, I'd be very flattered, actually.
Okay.
Because if I was a cultural icon enough that you could use an image of mine...
Yeah, then people would recognize your name and go, oh, Maya, this is... Not what her show was like at all, or something.
But the fact that it's part of, that somebody would use it. No, I would not object to that. Okay. I would probably like the stuff that you're describing, because I have a hearty appetite for bad taste,
Okay, this is just what came to mind. How do people feel when they say, oh, others should understand? Would you understand yourself if it happened to you? And that's just, it's a feeling kind of question, not a legal question.
But each case is so very, very different.
Our work has been sampled by someone who sold a million records. And I don't like what they did. I don't like how they sampled us. And they never asked permission. But I think it's fine. I have no problem with it whatsoever. It's none of my business, actually. It's really not any of my business at all. What someone does with a 5-second chunk of something that I made.
Okay, Hope, did you have a question?
Yeah, I was just going to point out that I mean Harlequin and other big corporations use images that are material is circulating as part of popular culture. We are actually under a
No, they still might have gone after her for other reasons. But I'd like to ask Aaron if he maybe would like to comment about what we in Canada could possibly do. One thing I mentioned earlier about copyright is that within Canadian copyright law, parody is not considered an exception, where it is in Canada, or in the United States, sorry. And I was asked yesterday if there's anything that I'd like to come out of this dialogue or conversation, I would like to see a change of that the Canadian copyright law become more flexible. And so Aaron, we talked about this at breakfast, and he came up with some really interesting ideas.
I'd like to comment on the Harlequin case. For a breach of copyright to occur, there has to be a substantial taking. And here there's nothing that you've taken from the author. Nothing. In respect to the moral rights, it has to be something that is an alteration that's prejudicial to the artist, and there's no comment from an artist, because in all probability there is no artist. There's a graphic designer that's in-house. And I think the friends at Harlequin are just being a bit silly. They should really honor you for what you've done and taking their imagery and turning it from pulp art to high art. In respect to Canada, there is an ongoing dialogue between the arts community and government in respect to revision of copyright. The Copyright Act is not etched in rock. Over the past 20 years, it has gone through a number of revisions, both internally and also because of externals, such as the Uruguay World Trade situation, where we have added, amongst other things, performers' rights. We have added all kinds of rights for the creator. And in the United States, they've expanded and extended the Copyright Act to life of the author plus 70 years rather than 50 years. And that was done so that it would be in conformity with the change that occurred in the European Union. When the European Union started to harmonize their laws, they found that Germany had life plus 70 years. And so they decided they would all expand the rights of the author for the additional 20 years after death to enable more rights to inure to the benefit of the estate. But in Canada, there are ongoing white papers, green papers, and opportunities for the community, the arts community, to let their needs and their rights be known. And through that consultation and consultative type of operation, we're able to obtain changes to the Copyright Act. I was involved in one on behalf of architects. You were involved in one, Barbara, in respect to artists. The publishers and authors have had expansion as well for the protection of authors' rights in Canada. And it's ongoing, and it continues to be ongoing. So you do have an opportunity to participate in the process. By the way, there are exceptions in the Copyright Act to permit uses of material that are under copyright for private research, for study, for comment, for newspaper review, and things of that nature. And there's also new changes that have occurred to assist public institutions, not-for-profit archives and museums, to obtain some benefits as well under the Act. So again, there are all these changes that are occurring as the need is known and made known to the government.
What's interesting is that the drawing I showed you of Goofy being tied up, that was on the front page of the arts section of the Globe and Mail. It could be there because it was a news reporting story. I can show it in plug-in because this is educational, but I cannot show that image in a gallery, because it doesn't fall under any exceptions. And that's my beef, because I think it should be able shown in the gallery. Any other questions?
Can
Yeah, please, if you, okay, Jeffrey, and then come on up to the front, if that's okay. And Natalka, you wanted to respond?
I just had a comment on your comment.
Okay, yeah, and then we'll hear from Jeffrey.
No, well, the fact is, Diane, is that you could show it in a gallery, and you could take the chance. You decided not to, but my take would be, like, don't self-censor. Like, wait for that letter to come, you know, and then deal with it. I think... I wouldn't censor my work, you know. I wouldn't be take that preemptive strike and be cautionary. I would advise not to. I would say, you know, I think that's very important. The freedom of expression is a very important, and what you're doing is not harming, and it's it is parody. You should be allowed, you know. So
yeah, just to comment on Natalka's comment on my comment. this whole experience followed a pretty intense year I'd had after I'd done this exhibition called Monstrance. My stress level was a little bit fragile, and the whole issue around dead rabbits had divided the community. And I was advised by Shirley Medill to talk to this brilliant lawyer who would advise me. And Robert Enright, good friend of mine, said, yes, talk to Aaron, and, you know, he'll give you really good advice. And so when his advice came to me and suggested that I not risk it, I took that advice because I was not willing to jump into the fire so soon after being doused. You know, I mean, it took a long time for that other fire to go out. You want to comment about my comment, about your comment, about my comment? Okay, let's go to Jeffrey.
I'm wondering about, in the case of the Harlequin books and the Disney stuff, is not the appropriation of the, or we'll call them samples, actually more or less advertising for them? Because let's say, for example, we saw the art show with the Harlequin covers and later find the same Harlequin book at a secondhand store or whatnot, you'll be more likely to buy it. The same thing, people with taste that might not consume much Disney might really like the idea of, do you know what I mean, Mickey set on fire, and might now go out and buy the Mickey depicted in the painting to do a similar thing with it. So isn't it, in fact, helping them?
There's something that I don't hear mentioned very often, which is that if you're a lawyer working for a company, you got to find things to do. You know, billable hours. Well, I'm convinced that a lot of what drove all the lawsuits in the music industry over sampling was just lawyers are just trying to find something to justify their $400, you know, dollars an hour that they're being paid. And they keep coming up with ideas. And that was definitely... You know, that was probably an element. So there's so many factors into why someone would bring a suit that don't have anything to do with anything that's logical or rational or anything.
Next, please.
Can I comment on that?
Oh, yes.
One of the things we have to realize is that corporations have to concern themselves with their value and their shareholders. And today, the value of most corporations no longer exists in inventory. It doesn't exist in bricks and mortar. It exists in intellectual property. So the copyrights that Walt Disney owns and the trademarks that Walt Disney owns are the value of the company. And so they get very nervous when there is something that occurs in the marketplace that may affect that value, because it can affect their share value and their stockholders, and they feel they have a responsibility for their stakeholders. Sometimes they get a little bit too aggressive simply because they're nervous, and you have to make them feel at ease.
Okay. I'm not good at that.
Give them a nice massage.
I'm not sure if this is meant, I think I read this in the fair use book about the U2 trial that Negative Land went through. Is not the United States of America's national anthem based on a melody of a popular song at the time that it was created?
Oh yeah, our national anthem, the melody is stolen from an English drinking song.
Right, right.
Yes, that's
and,
true.
Natalka, were you aware, and I think this is true, that the creator of Harlequin is from Winnipeg, just out of curiosity?
Actually, when I was here for the show, I brought a whole stash back.
And you have the support of the Winnipeg Art Gallery, so that should have been enough. But my main point kind of expands on the point that the gentleman made before, that collage as a art form, in a way, should be looked at as unpaid free promotion for the corporate content holder, and in fact, the creators of the arrangements should maybe even receive royalties from commerce inspired by viewing of the collage that they create. And as long as the sampled amount isn't too much of an infringement of the original, I don't see why there's such apprehension towards this, because it's not going to, it's only going to increase interest and actually give it maybe a little more value than it initially should have or initially had.
But Aaron's point's a good one. It makes him nervous, you know, and but we did a project that was all using Pepsi advertisements, cut up and rearranged a whole thing called Dyspepsy. Well, it was obviously some critical kind of thing in some way, but interestingly enough, after Pepsi's attorneys got a hold of it, and they did, they let it alone. They just let it exist. They just said, okay, we're not going to do anything, which I thought was a good response. And actually, what was great for Pepsi was the Dyspepsy was actually very popular on non-commercial college radio in the United States, so that the name Pepsi was being heard constantly for months in on you know these non-commercial stations. So I think that they it could have been that that entire project was a covert ad campaign that they hired us to do. And actually, the reason why I can afford to come here at all is because all that money I got from Pepsi for doing it.
I'm curious about the. How much in an original piece of work or an advertisement that you take as an artist and change one thing about it and then claim it as your own, how is the copyright rules, how are they affected by that? I guess I'm thinking about the Adbusters publication that did an ad on Absolute Vodka, and I think they were sued by Absolute Vodka, and they purposefully misspelt Absolute and then used it in a situation of parody, and I think they won their case. I'm not sure.
I think it was just threats from Absolute,
right,
and
right.
But they didn't back down, and Absolute finally just stopped threatening them.
Yeah, because it was a great advertisement for them, which is what the magazine, I think, eventually also mentioned, that you know it was being publicized for them.
But back to your original question, maybe Aaron can talk about this. What percentage of a work of art has to be changed in order for, because you mentioned yesterday about it being substantially different. What does that mean?
There's no protection of an idea. There's only protection of how you express that idea. So that if you come up with an idea for a TV show or a quiz show for a picture and so on, there's no protection for that. What there is protection for is how you implement it, how you draw it, how you paint it, how you sing it, and so on. And in respect to what will cause a work to be in competition with that is if, in fact, you try to replicate it. There's no such thing as any percentages. It depends on the facts. As an example, a Harlequin some years ago asked me to do some work for them. And they were doing a book on the history of love. And they decided that they wanted to put in a one-liner by Woody Allen, and that they were going to do that. And I suggested to them that they would end up being sued by Woody Allen. They said, well, it's only one line. In the publishing industry, you can go up to so many hundred words and there's no problem. And I said, that's not true. It will all depend on the facts of each situation. For instance, you may be able to reproduce 30 pages of a book that's 600 pages long, but if you are repeating and publishing a sonnet which is only 3 lines long but contains the whole kernel of what is being stated by the author, that is a violation of copyright. And for instance, if you wanted to repeat and publish Dorothy Parker's saying that men don't make passes at dames that wear glasses, it's a one-liner, but that's enough to be a breach of her copyright because it contains the whole essence of what it's about. So the courts, and what the courts do is they look at each fact situation and see what is substantial, because it has to be a substantial taking before it's a violation. And the substantial taking has to be that it takes the whole concept that's being expressed and it's transplanted that into your work. But there's nothing wrong for somebody like Van Gogh to use Japanese wood blocks as an inspiration, or Picasso to use African sculpture as an inspiration, or for an artist to paint pictures and serial imagery so that he can sell or she can sell painting number one, but then there's a variation painting number two and so on, the way Andy Warhol did. So each fact situation is looked at by a court. And even in courts where there are three judges, for instance, in courts of appeal, you will find that there'll be two judges who go one way and one judge will go another way and dissent. And it's really difficult trying to draw the line between what is permitted and what's not permitted. And I'm afraid that that's the best that I can do for you.
Would anyone like to comment on the panel?
Well, but you don't automatically just get sued because you do something like that. There's no art police floating in the ether who just knows everything you're doing, at least not yet. So it kind of depends. I sometimes wish that some of these issues, particularly when it comes to creative reuse, I wish they were all being argued and debated about just from a completely ethical, aesthetic, philosophical standpoint, and the law wasn't being involved, you know. Vanilla Ice makes Ice Ice Baby by taking a huge chunk of Under Pressure by Queen. Well, he actually made a lot of money off of that, but I think that his use of the song was completely unimaginative, and so he should just be punished by going to boring, lame art jail. And that should be sort of the end of the story. That would be it, you know. But that's not how it works out, at least not in the United States. But then if you're playing the game of getting your work out there at a more mainstream level, then these concerns, of course, do come up, and they're more legitimate. This is why Negative Land, after all the trouble we went through, went back to running our own label. We're completely 100% do-it-yourself, because we don't want to worry about an attorney at an independent record label breathing down our necks about what we should and should not be doing when we're making music. We have actually run into some significant problems in getting our CDs pressed, though. The RIAA has so thoroughly intimidated CD plants in the United States with fears of you're going to be punished for bootlegging and copyright, bootlegging and piracy, or something that's called contributory infringement. You knowingly press a work that has infringing material on it. You could be held liable as well. So we had a plant that had worked with us for 6 years that turned around one day and announced that they would no longer press any of our CDs anymore because we couldn't prove to them we'd cleared all of our samples. But I felt like this was something that would be called prior restraint. I'm not allowed to publish the work to have my day in court to prove that it's a fair use. So it's very complicated. Ultimately, we found a pressing plant that doesn't pay any attention to anything we do. And we like them, and we've continued to do stuff with them, and we've had no problems. But it really caused some real hell for us for a while. Definitely.
We have three speakers lined up.
Yeah, I just want to know, in Canada, what is the most severe penalty you can have for copyright infringement? I mean, like, can you go to jail, or is it?
Aaron?
Yes.
It's interesting we were just talking about it. I just
5 years.
Well, is
you
that...
You can go to jail for 5 years and pay how much money?
Is this true? I just...
Yes. $1 million.
Yeah, has there been any precedence with this happening in Canada? Is there an artist rotting in jail?
Is it jail over piracy kind of things? Is it jail when it's just like bootlegging piracy type stuff?
Most of the time for a breach of copyright, what has happened in Canada is when the plaintiff is successful, the courts have issued injunctions to prevent further material from being distributed. They have also, well, I'll give you a case. There was a case out in Alberta, Pro Arte, where a company there reproduced the most popular poster of the era that they had picked up from the United States. And they knew it was under copyright, but they thought they can get away with it because maybe the Americans wouldn't look up north. But eventually they did find out, they hired a lawyer in Alberta, brought an action against this company. And the judge determined that the company knew it was breaching copyright. There was a copyright notice on the material. And as a result, the judge said, what you have to do is destroy all the existing inventory, destroy all the materials that you have used to create this poster. You have to account for your profits and pay those profits over to the American company. And in addition to that, because you knew what you were doing and that it was wrong, we're going to award punitive damages against you, and you have to pay the costs of the court case. And the poster was Farrah Fawcett.
I just want to say one thing. Is I made a movie recently with the University of Manitoba, or I finished it a year ago, and they since then they've threatened me with legal action if I showed it to anyone, and that more money has been spent on lawyers than probably like triple has been spent on lawyers than was ever spent on the movie. And I just, to me, it's just showing me like how much this is really just turning into a legal kind of market almost.
What became clear in the workshops Aaron did yesterday, whenever you make an arrangement with someone, get a contract where money's involved. And he it was quite clear. He sort of mentioned that faculty at the School of Art, if we write anything or publish anything, unless it states otherwise, that everything we do is owned by the University of Manitoba. And everyone in the audience sort of went like that. So. Okay, next question.
Mine's just a comment. Earlier in the presentation, it was mentioned that Carfac has fought long and hard to ensure copyright protection for artists. And if you do a piece about your vegan viewpoints, you don't want it used in any way, shape, or form, perhaps by a meatpacking plant. And I think do unto others as you want others to do unto you. And there are all kinds of ways of dealing with this. You can write and ask people for permission to use some of their work. That's done all the time in publishing. But as I say, I think we shouldn't be shooting down in flames rules that Carfac is fighting hard to get protection for artists. And I think it depends on which side of the fence you want to be on. Like, do you want to assert the right for artists, but not for people or companies whose images artists want to use?
Yeah, good point. Did you want to comment on that, Barbara?
Well, that's one of the ironies we always have to deal with, is that if we fight against the restrictions in order to create, we're between a rock and a hard place. I mean, the same corporations are coming and using our stuff in ways that we don't want to. I mean, I don't know how happy you'd be if your work was stolen by a corporation to make a profit. Of course we'd fight that. So we do have to tread a very fine line. And I think it's a good point. A lot of times if you ask for permission, if you're using another artist's work, they'll say yes.
In the music industry, though, that just doesn't work, because you'd be spending thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars negotiating fees with lawyers and trying to work it all out. And in the case of our work, of course, our work's critical. So no one's going to agree, because we're not saying anything necessarily very nice about them. But there's these interesting tensions between where copyright can be used to protect art, and you can also see how copyright can then, those same rules can also to stifle and suppress art or have a real chilling effect on what people want to do with their creativity.
Certainly one of the common practices of postmodernist art is to be subversive. And the whole idea of me writing Disney and saying, hey, I want to kill your mouse, what do you think? You know, they're just not going to, they're not going to say yes. Like you say, they're not going to say yes. Mm-hmm. So I think it's just really, it's a nice idea for us to write these people and wait for them to come back, but, you know, I don't want...
But I don't regard Disney as a creator. I regard Disney as a corporation that owns creators' works.
Yeah. So but still, those are the people that we would have to write to, or whomever, Warner Brothers or whatever. Next speaker, please.
So, Diane, can I draw your rabbit? You know what I'm saying? You said about asking Disney, and I'm kind of thinking about the portrait end of it, and I tend to draw people, and something about them, either an experience or what they say, or whatever I've been doing, there's a connection. I connect with that person, and so I try to tell a story about that person. And so, you know, I might do something, you know, I just draw this person, then all of a sudden I want to expand on it, and I might put this portrait in a cup, for instance, you know. And it's a real person, and then I might see a, as an example, I did this sculpture, and I saw this shadow, and so I just called it hair out of place, and I happened to tell this person that, you know, I called it hair out of place, and I saw this hair out of place, and she says, I'm going to sue you, because she took it in another way, so now I'm going to call it Valerie, you know what I'm saying, it's not a big deal, but, you know, so, and then, you know, I had heard you talk at the camp, I don't know if you remember, and you posed for me, so I painted you. And what struck me about you was that I felt sorry that people didn't understand what you were trying to say. You went through so much stress, as you had mentioned, and so I was trying to convey that in what I was the portraits I was doing of you. So now, you know, there's like six pieces to your portrait, and there is a little rabbit in it, but you know, in a different,
it's your piece.
It's my piece, it's not your piece. Right. What I'm trying to convey here is a message.
Yeah, so you're...
But there's no getting away from it that there is, it's about what you are trying to say in a different way. And so I'm a little kind of, I'm wondering, you know, am I stepping over, am I pushing the boundaries here? You would have to basically, I guess, see it, or Diane, can I draw your rabbit? You know, or Pepsi, can I kill your, or, you know, Walt Disney, can I kill your
well,
Mickey
I don't know.
Mouse? You know, this kind of thing?
Yeah, so you're asking me, am I going to sue you? No, I don't know, Aaron, do you think I should sue her?
I don't think you're going
no
to.
Grounds. No.
Yeah. You know, I don't think, you know, if you saw it, you would. And as a matter of fact, I really don't care if it gets shown. But I'm just saying it's something that I've been thinking about.
Okay.
And I'm also wondering, say if I decided to draw a famous person. Can I sell prints of that famous person? It's my own sketch.
If you did a drawing of
Madonna.
Yeah. Could I then sell prints
okay,
of Madonna?
Aaron,
I don't know.
Actually, that's a question. Can Madonna is a public figure. Can someone do a drawing of Madonna and sell them?
You're not affected by copyright. You're affected by privacy laws. As a person that earns her living from her image and her voice, she has the right to control whatever material goes out in respect to the commerce of her face. And so there's a privacy right that exists in Canada, in the U.S. as well. And it even extends to somebody's voice. Bette Midler sued the Ford Motor Company in the United States because her understudy had taken on a commercial using a voice that sounded like Bette Midler when Bette Midler had refused to do that commercial. And so there are rights that are given to public personas that don't exist for people like you and me, maybe for me, but not you.
Would that not tie in with, I'm sorry, I forget his name, you know, you're talking about voice music, which we just heard. That's a privacy issue also. Now, when I'm talking about famous people, I just happen to see...
We should go to a next person, that's what I think.
Okay. I just happen to see a Van Gogh at Mayberry, and that is a famous person. You know, this kind of thing?
Yeah,
you can go on and on and on.
You can.
You know, it's interesting.
Okay. Kevin?
The conundrum, okay. I see it like it's something, it's really ambiguous. It's very unclear. Yeah, okay, talk closer. It's something about protecting me as an artist, which is cool and very fine. But the other end of it is that we have pop culture. Pop culture rules people's lives. There are people that are watching television for 8 hours a day, and it becomes a substantial part of their subconscious. It becomes their big part of their dream state. And it's not only somebody who's living here It's somebody who's living in China or somebody who's living in Japan. And these big corporations are saying, no, you're not allowed to use that information. And I just say, fuck them. I mean, that's ridiculous. It's like they completely build. What's happening is that they are building a culture, like a culture that is affecting us so profoundly that we're dreaming it of these events or these narratives. And then they're saying, it may sound a little paranoid, but a kind of way of controlling people all over the world in terms of like narrative and what they want, what they desire. And then once we turn around and try and use it, they say, you're not allowed to do that. Although it's like, it's in my dream state. So what? I say it's my property.
I totally agree that when I think about the phrase, you're soaking in it, I always think about Madge, you know, that commercial where she's, you're soaking in it. It's for some Palmolive soap or something like that. I don't want you're soaking in it. I don't want to think about Madge and that bloody soap, but I do every time. So, you know, absolutely right. It's like this subliminal seduction. What? And if it's part of our psyche, why can we not just then use it in our work? Mark, you've got something to say.
Oh, just something that's very interesting that's going on because of, again, technology, how laws are always going to be behind, is that because of the internet and the web, and because of all these new technologies, what we're seeing happen in the world in all kinds of ways, and it, from, you know, terrorism to downloading Eminem songs that you're not supposed to, is that it's the decentralization of power and of control. We're now starting to really be in the driver's seat as the users of cultural information. It's increasingly easy to take this stuff and do whatever the heck you want to do with it. And that's just a real, real big shift. These companies are not used to that. They're used to us being passive consumers. You know, in the same way technology is allowing things to happen with hacking and terrorism, and there's all kinds of ways in which the world is undergoing a really dramatic shift. And I think it's becoming basically just a big, huge mess from now on, forever. That there's going to be no...
No more Mr. Nice Guy.
No more this, yeah. Right. And so it's exciting, it's scary, it's wonderful, it's a whole lot of lot of different things.
I'm just going to wrap up. Is that okay? You had one more quick question,
sure.
And then I want to wrap
really
up.
Really quick.
Okay.
There just seems to be so much fear connected to this issue, and that concerns me. So I was wondering, what would your ultimate advice be to artists? I know, Mark, you would probably say go out and create your art. Just do it, because... You know, say if I'm a filmmaker and I want to make a piece that's critical of McDonald's, some montage piece, I'm not going to call McDonald's. I'm not going to write them a letter. I'm going to make my work. And who should I be afraid of?
McDonald's.
No.
And is McDonald's going to find out that I've made a film about them? I don't think they will. But I don't think we should also hide our work.
So the practical consideration is simply distribution. That there are distribution channels that you will be shut out of because of that. But there are, if you are a persistent, persnickety kind of a person, there's all kinds of ways you can get your stuff out there anyway. So.
Freedom of speech.
Yeah.
Okay. I think it's pretty clear today that this conversation has to continue. It hasn't happened in Canada that often, and it's pretty wonderful that it's going to begin. I mean, I know it has happened in other cities, but I think this is the first time in Winnipeg that we've had such a major conversation, beginning with Aaron's workshops on Friday at the University of Manitoba, and then Mark's last night in the panel discussion today. Tomorrow, Natalka Husar will be giving her presentation 2:00 at Video Pool. Please, you just saw a little tiny vignette of what she's been doing. Please don't forget, that's tomorrow at 2:00. I just want to thank the panelists for their generosity and their humor and their anger and their sense of commitment to what they believe in, and I hope all of us continue with this conversation. Thank you.